When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
President Biden prepares a major announcement on student debt. Plus, the IRS reviews security for tax collectors. And 6 months since Russia's invasion of Ukraine, we'll get the Ukrainian and Russian views on the conflict.
The Ukrainians are starting to take the initiative, forcing the Russians to react to their moves much more than the other way around.
There is no indication being given from state sources that Russia is about to give up its goals.
It's Wednesday, August 24th. I'm Luke Vargas with the Wall Street Journal, and here's the AM edition of What's News, the top headlines and business stories moving your world today. U.S. President Joe Biden is expected to announce today that he will cancel some federal student loan debt for tens of millions of Americans via executive action. As of Tuesday evening, senior Biden administration officials were still ironing out the details of the announcement, according to people familiar with the discussions. Some of those people expected Biden to opt for $10,000 in debt cancellation, but cautioned that figure could change. The long-awaited executive action would provide unprecedented relief for borrowers, but is certain to draw political and legal challenges. Biden is also expected to announce an extension of the pandemic pause on repayment of student debts, which were set to resume after August 31st. Turning to yesterday's U.S. elections, New York Representative Gerald Nadler has defeated fellow veteran Representative Carolyn Maloney in a Democratic primary after redistricting forced them to compete for a single House seat. Nadler drew national attention when he helped lead the first impeachment of then-President Donald Trump. And in Florida, former Republican Attorney General and Governor Charlie Crist won a Democratic primary for governor, defeating State Agriculture Commissioner Nikki Fried. Journal reporter Ariane Campo Flores says Crist pitched himself as being able to defeat incumbent Republican Governor Ron DeSantis in November by uniting Democrats and independents.
Crist vowed that on his first day of office where he elected, he would sign an executive order protecting abortion rights. Looking ahead to the fall, Crist now faces what many consider an uphill battle in taking on DeSantis. DeSantis has a huge fundraising advantage. He raised his profile very significantly over the course of the pandemic, but it's sure to be a hard-fought and closely watched contest.
The U.S. Federal Trade Commission has said it is dropping Meta CEO Mark Zuckerberg from a lawsuit filed last month, blocking Meta platforms from buying a small virtual reality company. According to a court document filed yesterday, the Meta chief executive agreed not to purchase the startup Within Unlimited and its fitness app Supernatural in his personal capacity or through any other entities he controls. Last month, the FTC had said that Meta, Facebook's parent company, is already a key player at every level of the virtual reality sector, and that expanding the company's virtual reality empire by buying the fitness app violates antitrust laws and lessens competition. Meta declined to comment, and the FTC didn't immediately respond to a request for comment. The U.S. Internal Revenue Service is reviewing safety and security protocols for its employees, citing threats, misinformation, and social media postings following Congress's decision to beef up the tax agency's enforcement efforts. In a message to employees Tuesday, IRS Commissioner Charles Rettig mentioned unspecified threats that he described as concerning. And retailer Bed Bath & Beyond has clinched a loan deal to shore up its liquidity as it tries to weather recent missteps. That's according to people familiar with the matter. The company told prospective lenders Tuesday it had selected a lender following a marketing process conducted by JPMorgan Chase, people familiar with the matter said. The size and terms of the final deal weren't immediately clear. Bed Bath & Beyond didn't immediately respond to a request for comment. J.P. Morgan declined to comment. Coming up 6 months into the war in Ukraine, we'll hear from two Journal reporters on how leaders in Kyiv and Moscow view the conflict and their respective paths to victory. That story after the break.
Join the Wall Street Journal at the Future of Everything Festival on May 21st to 23rd in New York City, where diverse global newsmakers share unique perspectives on navigating a changing world. Immerse yourself in live performances, explore pioneering technologies, and indulge in the city's inventive culinary scene. As a podcast listener, enjoy 20% off current ticket rates with code PODCAST. Visit wsj.com/FOEF podcast to secure your spot.
Six months after Russia launched its full-scale invasion of Ukraine, signs are accumulating that the balance on the military and economic battlefields is slowly tilting the way of Kyiv and its Western backers. Wall Street Journal reporter Marcus Walker has just returned from Ukraine, where he spoke to top officials and Ukrainians across the country to get a read on the current phase of the conflict. And Marcus joins us now with more. Marcus, thanks for being with us.
My pleasure.
Tell us about the stage of the war we are currently in. Can we mark this as a distinct phase, perhaps, from what's come before?
It's a very interesting phase because it looks like the Ukrainians are starting to take the initiative in the sense that they are forcing the Russians to react to their moves much more than the other way around. And that's a contrast to how it was 2 or 3 months ago when this Russian steamroller was inching forwards very slowly in this grueling battle for Donbass. And the Ukrainians were really struggling to stop them there and were taking very heavy losses. Now, that Russian offensive is still continuing, but getting slower and slower. And although the Ukrainians have not managed to stop the Russians entirely from taking the odd village here and there, it really looks like it's the Ukrainians now that are forcing the Russians to think about what they're going to do next.
What has contributed to that sense of initiative?
One thing is the arrival of more and more potent Western weapons, especially from the US, but also from some European countries, and most famously, of course, the HIMARS rocket launchers, which the Ukrainians are putting to devastating effect, attacking Russian logistics and ammunition and fuel and command and control behind Russian lines, and that really does seem to have sapped a lot of the energy out of the Russian offensive.
With more advanced weapons and a sense of initiative, should we expect Ukraine then to be attempting some sort of large-scale counter-assault against Russian positions?
The Ukrainians still don't have the trained manpower or the armor or the advantage in firepower to really launch a large-scale frontal assault against Russian positions, even in the south, where the Ukrainians do seem to be gaining the initiative. The Russians are well dug in, and in this war, both sides have been struggling to actually advance and take ground. So the Ukrainians seem to be trying to make a virtue of necessity. Instead of an all-out assault, they're trying to undermine the Russian position in the south by more indirect means, and that means attacking Russian logistics, fuel, ammo, command positions behind the lines, isolating Russian forces, leaving them in vulnerable positions, and leaving the Russians with a dilemma whether to withdraw from those weak positions or face the possible threat of being destroyed there. And that would copy the strategy that the Ukrainians used successfully to force the Russians away from Kyiv and northern Ukraine early in the war, which was the biggest reversal that the Russians have suffered so far.
And Marcus, where do we stand now in terms of Western support for sanctions against Russia and support for aid to Ukraine?
The near universal determination to see this thing through was one thing that struck me very much on my visit to Ukraine and my many conversations with many people all over Ukraine. So yes, the motivation is absolutely there. And this is a country that really believes it will win. People really believe it's a question of when, not if, although the expectation is it'll be a long and painful war still to come. So the crucial factor will ultimately be the position of the West, as well as the motivation they need, the weapons, and the financial support from the West, because the Ukrainian government is also really struggling to make ends meet. It's struggling with the economic damage that Russia has done to the Ukrainian economy. So on the Western side of things, it does really seem that political support is holding, that divisions have not really emerged that would undermine the Western strategy of sanctions against Russia and support for Ukraine. And this is contrary so far to Putin's expectation that he would be able to weaken the will of the West by inflicting economic pain on Europe, by inflicting an energy crunch on the European economy, that he would be able to split up the Western coalition supporting Ukraine. So far, it's not happening. The pain is there, but the political fragmentation is not visible.
That was Wall Street Journal reporter Marcus Walker, just back from Ukraine. Marcus, thank you so much.
My pleasure.
From the latest in Ukraine, let's now get a read on the situation in Russia. And for that, we're joined from Moscow by the Wall Street Journal's Moscow bureau chief, Ann Simmons. Ann, thank you for being with us.
Thank you for having me.
We've just heard from Marcus Walker about some of what's going right for Ukraine in the current conflict, 6 months on. What is the view from Russia?
Well, the public face of Russia is that things are going very well, that Russia has not been greatly impacted by sanctions, and that it is, in fact, making tremendous progress in this conflict, which Russia refers to as being still a special military operation. They are still not willing to call it a war. If they were to do that, it would mean that the Russian government would be in a position to actually declare a mass mobilization. So the view from Russia is one of confidence. That's the public view. Of course, if you are inside Russia, inside Moscow, inside St. Petersburg, the big cities, on the surface, things haven't changed at all. Restaurants are still open. People are going about their daily lives. Shops are still stocked, quite full. But around the kitchen table in many Russian households, there is a conversation that has started about whether or not this war is going to last a really long time. Will Russians be isolated and ostracized from the rest of the world, ordinary Russians? Or will this come to an end? Having said this, there is still tremendous support for President Vladimir Putin in terms of this military campaign in Ukraine.
What is the effect of Western sanctions on Russia? You mentioned shops are still being stocked.
Sanctions are definitely biting, but Russia has actually done pretty well so far in terms of sanctions proofing its economy. And that is largely due to the fact that Russia, as you know, is a huge energy provider, and everyone, Europe at least, still depends quite a lot, several European countries, on Russian oil and gas. Now, having said that, of course, there is data to indicate that Russia's GDP has actually declined in the last quarter. And that was kind of to be expected, but analysts have said it's not as bad or dramatic as what had been anticipated. So Russia has taken that basically and really run with it, saying, see, we are not impacted to the degree that the West had hoped we would be.
6 months into this war now, Anne, what seems to be Moscow's strategy?
Well, President Putin has made clear just a couple of weeks ago, actually, in July, speaking to the State Duma, which is the lower house of the Russian parliament, that the world hasn't seen anything yet, which kind of indicates this definite sense of defiance on the part of the Russian president. Certainly, there is no indication being given from state sources that this conflict is about to end anytime soon, or that Russia is about to give up its goals to take parts of Ukraine. Now, the goals appear to be, at this particular juncture, to be the seizure of parts of eastern Ukraine, the Donbas region of eastern Ukraine, the territories of Donetsk and Luhansk, and also parts of southern Ukraine, the areas of Zaporizhia and Kherson. And that appears to be the goal of Russia's military, according to many analysts we speak to. Now, whether or not Russia can actually achieve this goal remains to be seen. There has been several reports about Russia lacking the manpower, even though many Russian military analysts will argue otherwise. Russian analysts will tell you that they don't necessarily need to depend on manpower. It's all about artillery and pounding Ukraine with superior artillery, of which Russia has a lot.
That was Wall Street Journal Moscow bureau chief Ann Simmons joining us from Moscow. Ann, thank you as always.
Thank you.
And finally, let's switch gears to the world of work. In a new study, researchers from Harvard, the Georgia Institute of Technology, and MIT have found that for tech startups wondering where to locate their new companies, a winning answer is near another tech startup, and preferably one in a slightly different business. That is thanks to so-called knowledge spillovers, in which unplanned interactions let teams gather immediate feedback on ideas or quickly implement what they see working well for others. Wall Street Journal contributor Cheryl Winokur-Monk has more.
Well, the idea is it allows people to interact who might not otherwise interact, and it allows for this free exchange of ideas that might not happen in a remote setting. There's more of this natural flow between human beings when they're in close proximity to each other. And interestingly, the study found that beyond a certain distance, so in this case, startups that were working within 20 meters of each other, that's what they looked at. And if the distance was farther, it was like they were on different floors. The result wasn't the same. So the close proximity is what's important.
And that's What's News for Wednesday morning. We'll be back tonight with a new show. I'm Luke Vargas with The Wall Street Journal. Thanks for listening.